Hello and welcome to Beyond the Back Page on Neo FM with myself, Patrick Donoghue. On the show today, I'll be joined by Derek A. Bardowell, author of a new book entitled No Win Race, A Story of Belonging, Britishness and Sport. And I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Derek. Derek, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
How you doing, Patrick?
Not too bad. So, Derek, just at the start of the book, you mention a fight between Hagler and Minter. And you say in the book that was one of the earliest experiences where you saw racism in full flow. Can you tell us a little bit about that fight and why you saw the racism so bad on that night in Wembley?
So, Patrick, I think I wasn't really hugely aware of racism at that particular point. So when I was watching the fight, Minter being an English fighter, for me, I very much supported him. Why? Because I was born in England. What I didn't realize is that he had said before the fight that he would not let a black man ever take his title away from him. And the atmosphere in Wembley Arena for that particular fight, as he was fighting Marvin Hagler, a black American fighter, was very hostile, and it was very reflective of racism and the racial tensions at the time. So I was very much in conflict, because here was an English fighter who was, you know, born in the same country as myself, who had said or allegedly said something quite disparaging against someone with a similar skin tone to myself. And for me, it ended up being quite a massive transition point for me, you know, because very soon sport began to reflect a number of the issues that I would begin to experience in my day-to-day life.
And in the early 80s, it seemed that the picture you portray of England for yourself and black people, it seemed to be very, very tough. You had the Brixton riots, and so much so that in your book, and it really, really struck me, you said to your mother that you wanted to bleach your skin white, which when I was reading it, I just found it very, very sad. How tough was it in the early 80s, in that culture, was it growing up, and how tough was it for black people like yourself?
Well, you have to remember, in the early 80s, it was at the time a racist national party called the National Front was very much on the rise. And so outside of our school gates, the National Front used to leaflet to try and recruit young white kids to their party. So that's how close it was to your doorstep. And of course, there was, you know, lots of racist attacks that were frequent, but unsolved racist attacks. So the moral, well, the major panic for us was, on a day-to-day basis, these incidents were happening. And if you think about how, you know, people speak about some of the serious youth violence at the moment in London and some of those issues, I guess for us, growing up, our biggest fear was racist attacks, because it was a day-to-day issue, not just for black kids, but for Asian kids as well. And it was a very hostile atmosphere. I think what's really sad to me, I was reading a report recently where a number of young kids of color now are starting to bleach their skin, because they're feeling that fear now that we were, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And that, for me, I find, you know, really tragic, but also says a lot about how we haven't quite as progressed around this issue as many people think we have.
And was watching sport, it seemed from reading your book, it was a way for yourself and your father to bond. And you mentioned the West Indies cricket team. You said a great love of that team. Was watching sport and seeing role models, did sport provide an outlet where you could see people like yourself and have good role models for yourself?
Yeah, because, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, it was a way that my father and I bonded. It's the way that my son and I bond. So sport is very important to us. It's not everything. I don't, you know, watch sport with rose-tinted glasses and think, oh, just because someone succeeded in sport, life is much better. But it provides that wonderful arena for you to imagine and for you to take yourself away. And I think for me, you know, maybe I'm a bit romantic when it comes to sport, and the way that I've written the book is, you know, less of a sociological study and more of, you know, narrative and storytelling, because I wanted to bring out the fact that in sport, you know, you have these wonderful moments which can also bring out the worst in you in terms of, you know, your aggression and stuff. But at the same time, you see these wonderful moments of excellence which can completely disarm disarm you. And you've seen that historically, where an athlete does something absolutely brilliant and, you know, you absolutely go into a different zone and it's absolutely magnificent. Where there was a conflict for me was often in the fact that as I was watching something that was really beautiful, you would also see crowds booing, throwing bananas and things of that nature. So it would kind of tint or take away from that magnificence. I think seeing the West Indies, though, who really didn't bow to anyone and really absolutely, you know, more than anyone that I can remember, I've known so many people that loved and admired that West Indies team outside of the West Indies because they were so forceful. Yes, they beat England heartily a lot of the time, but they also did not bow down to any of the criticisms that they made. And I think when I saw the West Indies, I saw at least a conception of what real force and real assertiveness could look like on the sporting field. And for me, that gave me a lot of confidence in my own private life in terms of dealing with issues at school around racism and things of that nature.
And a lot of Irish people here were great fans of English football, and they would remember the bad days of the 80s, players like John Barnes getting awful abuse. Do you think the back then it was such a big deal, a black player playing for a club, when Viv Anderson got capped for England, it was such a big deal. Do you think that them players were successful in changing people's perceptions of black people, or do you think that is exaggerating the importance of sport and the role they had?
Yeah, I think where sport is powerful is that it can... It's very strong symbolically. So I don't think it necessarily changes, you know, society's perceptions per se. I think what it does is when you saw that wave of black players, not just in England, but across the UK, you saw the wave of black players coming in. They faced lots of hostility, but more black players came in, largely because of the great resilience of those players. Now, I wouldn't say that at that particular point race relations in society changed, but actually at some point it would have resonated with a lot of people that actually this isn't going to stop, and these players and these people are really good and absolutely brilliant. And I think symbolically something does slightly shift. Now, as I said, I wouldn't over-egg it in terms of it shifting society, but I would say that it provides a very powerful symbol, because at the end of the day, so many people watch sport. It's a billion pound industry, so it cannot fail to resonate when, you know, you now have, for example, an England team where the bulk of the team, or a large percentage of that team, will be black or of mixed heritage, and being successful with it, it does sway people in a certain way.
Yeah, and I want to ask you, it's you talk in the book about Anila Aluko, women's footballer, and it's very relevant considering the Women's Football World Cup's on at the moment. Would you mind, because some people mightn't be too familiar with that case, would you mind telling us a little bit about her experiences when she reported instances of racism? And can you just tell us a little bit how she got on when she reported what was happening to her?
Well, you know, essentially she had experienced racism within the English football team setup. And at some point, I think this was largely due to a press leak, it came out, and, you know, in the end, she ended up taking on the FA, and she ended up, you know, you know, with the FA acknowledging that there was racism within that England team setup. But that happened after a very long time. In the original report, when she originally reported this incident, you know, it was originally said, well, there wasn't a major incident, there wasn't a major issue, but only when it leaked to the press and it became more public was there an acknowledgement that there was a major issue in terms of race and racism within that England national team setup. Why that was most important was just in the fact that, one, Eniola was unbelievable in the way that she managed that situation. Two, I felt, and I, you know, a lot of people wouldn't have not only taken on the FA, but also stood up for and stood up so eloquently for the issue that she was taking on. I think, too, she looked at things, I think, from a systemic level. So very much from the basis of, you know, it's not just an individual incident, it's a wider cultural issue that needs tackling. And also for me, I think it really opened the door for a lot of the activism that you see now with people like Raheem Sterling and other male players. So I think it was really fundamental and important that, what she did, and I just didn't want that to be lost, given the amount of publicity that's happening now around Raheem Sterling, which is important, fundamental, and brilliant. But I don't think we should be forgetting what Eniola had done over the last couple of years to open those doors.
And do you think that there is a problem? Because it is great when people make stands, but it seems when people make stands about it, they are demonised and they really, really have to fight very, very hard. So does that kind of deter other sports people from coming forward? And they might be experiencing similar problems, but they're kind of reluctant because they know there's going to be a backlash coming.
Yeah, and you know, I would say that when I was a kid, I was probably a little less forgiving of athletes that wouldn't stand out. Because, you know, I grew up with Muhammad Ali, and he stood up for so much. And when you'd see athletes that wouldn't do that, you know, as a kid, you'd be looking at them and you'd say, oh my God, they're weak, why are they not standing up? You get older and you realize how tough it is for them to stand up, you know, for these issues, given that, one, they're in the public eye so much, two, you know, most of them will have a very short career. So as I've got older, I don't, you know, disrespect anyone that is quiet around these issues, but I will absolutely, you know, adore those players that will make a stance, because it is really difficult, it is really hard, you risk marginalization, not just from crowds, but from your own teammates in some instances. When you think about some of the incidents that's happened in Italian football in recent times, and you're also jockeying with, you know, a commercial career, sponsorship, as well as, you know, an athlete's career, which, you know, potentially is, you know, 3 or 4 years. You know, so it's really difficult, but I absolutely have the greatest respect for those athletes that will stand out, given that you know, their careers could be severely harmed by saying that. And I think with Raheem Sterling doing it, given that he has such a high profile, that will increase those athletes that will not be silent in the future.
And staying with soccer, there is a proposal now to bring in the Rooney Rule, which is in force in America. Because it's one thing that is remarked upon, and I know Saul Campbell highlighted it last year when he took over Macclesfield. Do you think that is going to make a difference? Because it is remarkable that managers from an ethnic background are not getting a fair crack at the whip. Do you think the Rooney Rule, it's proposed to be brought in now into football, do you think that's going to have a difference and make a difference?
I think it's a start, but I'm not sure the degree to which in America, for instance, the efficacy of that particular rule has continued to be successful. So I don't know the statistics, but I know originally it was very, very successful. I think how many years, 10, 15 years on, I don't know how successful it still continues to be.
Mm.
So I think it's definitely a start, but I would always say that it's not just about managerial positions. It's also about positions in the boardroom. It's also about media conceptions and how the media covers the sport. It's so much broader than just a manager getting an interview for a particular position. So I think, yes, it's a start. But if you look at some of the things that Raheem Sterling was calling for recently in terms of, you know, docking points or... other penalties in terms of potentially you would have to play a home game without a crowd there or without your home fans there. Two other people that have suggested maybe the players should walk off the pitch. I think it was Carlo Ancelotti who had said at one point, I'm going to call my players off the pitch.
Yeah.
Now that would be game changers. Those incidents or doing that would be game changers because that fundamentally affects the economics of the game. The Rooney rule does not affect the economics of the game. So the fact of it being there is nice and a nice to have, and I applaud them for doing it, but I would say, is that going to be the game changer in terms of tackling racism within the institution of sport or of soccer? No, because as I said, and I say this in the book, you know, a lot of people are a lot more comfortable with black people on the field of play than they are off the field of play. And it would take some more severe penalties or a greater, stronger vision for there to be a real massive systemic reform. This is more of a start, so we have to see where it goes.
And before I let you go, Derek, I just want to ask you a general question. I was reading a report recently, and it said since Brexit, racism is on the rise. What is your opinion? We've all a lot of interest in what's happening in England at the moment, and I was watching the debate last night, and Jeremy Hunt was saying that he felt England was a welcoming society. What is your experience? Do you think that there is still a lot of racism in English society and British society? What is your view?
Yeah, so, and again, I said this in the book, that after Brexit, you know, I was walking outside of my house with my kids, with my two kids, and faced racial abuse from a bunch of youths driving by in a car. You know, similarly, my father, who has, you know, came over back in 1960 and has been a hard-working citizen and a guy that, you know, absolutely, you know, loves England, has loved being in England and contributing in England, supports England in everything except for cricket. That's the one thing you won't support England
okay,
in.
Yeah.
Right. You know, was also abused as well as my mum, and you know, they're, you know, in their late 70s, you know. So, you know, for me, there's lots of underlying issues that have resurfaced as a result of Brexit, and I think for politicians to be ignoring that tells me that A, they have no direct experience of it, B, they're probably not equipped to be able to deal with it, and C, that for them, if they feel that they can pander to get more votes to those that are perhaps the perpetrators of this, then they will probably do that if it means more votes. But for them to ignore the reality of this as an issue, and that's from, I would say, three generations of black males who have experienced that in our own world, this is let alone what other people are experiencing in their communities, they would be absolutely wrong to be dismissing it or saying that this is not an issue, because if they dismiss it, trust me, some really severe problems will pop up in years to come if they don't address this and address this properly.
That's great. Listen, Derek, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
No problem.
The book is excellent, No Win Race, and it's out available now. Thanks a million for joining us this evening.
Thanks a lot, Patrick. I appreciate it.
That was great. That was Derek Bardwell joining us to discuss his new book, No Win Race, A Story of Belonging, Britishness and Sport. We're just nearly out of time. Just before we wrap up, I'm just going to go through. We had great drama in the highlight for next weekend, or this weekend even, for many people, will be the GAA All-Ireland Championship. There is three provincial finals on at the weekend. And I'm just going to look ahead. And we also have some fascinating qualifiers to play. So I'm just going to look ahead to some of the fixtures on. First up on Saturday, we have Cork and Kerry at Páirc Uí at 7 p.m. And the qualifiers on Saturday, Antrim and Kildare, that's at 3 p.m. Derry and Laois at 5 p.m. Longford and Tyrone at 5 p.m. Westmead and Limerick, that's a 6 p.m. kickoff, and it's Leitrim against Clare at 6 p.m. and a big game in Clonus, Monaghan against Armagh at 6 p.m. and Down and Mayo 7 p.m. That's going to be a fascinating game. A lot of people are saying Down have a great chance there, so it will be fascinating to see where that goes. Looking ahead to the Sunday, we have Dublin aiming to win yet another Delaney Cup, where they take on Meath at 4 p.m. And in the Ulster Senior Football Championship final, Cavan and Donegal face off at 2 p.m. Cavan hoping to win their first Ulster title since 1997, and I'm hoping to head to that game myself, and it should be a remarkable, really, really exciting game. It's been sold out since last Saturday, so it'd be very interesting to see how that game goes. And finally, in the women's football, we also have the Connacht final on at 4 p.m. That is Mayo and Galway. So plenty of sports action. We usually have a look at the League of Ireland fixtures. Next weekend is actually a break in fixtures, so we have a wee season break. So that's pretty much it from myself, Patrick Donoghue, on the show today. You can listen back to any of our previous shows by going on to the Near FM page and searching Beyond the Back page, and you get some of our previous podcasts. For more sport on Near FM, you can tune in at 10:30 on Saturday. Fergus will be here with his usual Saturday sports show, where he'll have a more comprehensive preview of all the fixtures taking place over the weekend. And no doubt Fergus will be taking a more in-depth look at that Dublin Mead game in Croke Park. And Fergus will also have a run through the results of the weekend on 8 on Sunday. That's pretty much it for this week. Tune in at the same thing next week. I'm going to leave you with a song from Bruce Springsteen as a new studio album out, and I've been listening to it over the last couple of days, and it's really, really a return to form. He's so prolific. So until next week, I will talk to you then. Enjoy your sporting week.